Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, hello, friend. I hope you're having an amazing day. See what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So hit that subscribe button. I am here today with one of my favorite people ever, someone I've been really excited to get on to the Ethics Experts, Amy Bernard-Bahn. Hello, Amy.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So I can try to sort of introduce you. You are a thought leader. You are a coach. You are a sort of a mainstay in the ethics and compliance profession. How would you describe yourself? Because I don't want to pay it short shrift.
Yeah, gosh, I would say I'm here to inspire and motivate and support change for people and organizations. So I do that through coaching, through writing, and through advocacy work for governance professionals, as well as for diversity initiatives such as Women on Boards. And then I actually serve on boards as well.
So, you know, you've also written a new book that's just come out. And, you know, part of the reason I've been so excited to get you on the Ethics Experts is I think we kind of look at the world in a lot of the same way. I think we see a lot of the same opportunities for folks, particularly in the ethics and compliance field, to elevate within their companies. I think we see some opportunity for the broader field to elevate in general. And you just have this really interesting way about you, this interesting energy, these interesting perspectives that are both aspirational, but also tactical and operational. And you do a really nice job of kind of bridging both of those things. So just super excited to get you on today and pick your brain and provide some more value to the folks out there that are trying to, you know, climb the mountain that they're climbing.
Thank you. Me too.
So why don't we start with kind of how you got here? I mean, your story is one of my favorites. How did you kind of get to where you're at now? The circuitous path that you followed really, I think, layered in a bunch of great tools into your toolbox, but it's just really a fascinating journey that you've been on.
Sure. And, you know, look, it makes sense in retrospect, looking in the rearview mirror, right? But at the time, it was zigzagging and arcing and up and down. And so I want to give people hope that might be where I was in some of the, what I'd say, caverns or divots in my career. I started off as a lawyer. I went to Georgetown and did a lot in labor and employment. And I was a fellow at the ACLU and helped lobby through the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was an amazing job. And then the reality of student loans hit me and I realized, oh my God, I've got to get a real job because the ACLU is amazing, but nonprofits wouldn't pay for my student loans, basically. Right. But I always had a desire to help and to try to be a part of something bigger than just me that would last after I'm gone, frankly. And so I cut my teeth at a litigation firm where I did plaintiff and defense work, which wound up being a real gift. It was not a prestigious law firm. If it had been, they would have been either plaintiff or defense. And so at the time it was kind of like, aw, you know, but, but at the time, you know, again, you can't see it. It was so awesome because I got the perspective of the employer and the employee. And I could take clients that we felt at the firm, and I had the privilege because the lucky stroke, the labor and employment lawyer partner left. And they were like, well, do you want to be the one to vet these cases? So I got 30 minutes with the client, and I would make a decision on whether we'd take a case or not based on the facts. So it had to be very quick analysis around, you know, was someone wronged? What's our likelihood of success on the merits, that kind of thing. Super helpful later on.
Totally.
When I was eventually miserable, which depending on your point of view, didn't take very long, 3.5 years. And felt really lost. I didn't like the billable hours. I didn't like, the metrics of job satisfaction for a law firm didn't work for me, which is hours and kind of money and, mm-hmm. and that. And for me, it was more having an impact and doing the right thing. And so I took about a year off. It was one of the scariest things I've ever done. I quit and I had no plan. I mean, zero. My husband and I had just gotten married and he was fabulously supportive, or I probably wouldn't have been able to do it in either emotionally or financially. But we traveled in Asia. I founded a nonprofit for the opera and picked up some marketing and PR skills. Again, something I never planned, but I did. I learned fundraising and met a whole ton of people that are still some of my best friends to this day, just through that volunteer work. Mm-hmm. And then I found HR. And I thought, you know, this is a good values fit. I can get to problems and prevent worse things from happening before they happen. And that was a really good values fit, because a lot of litigation that I had done, you see it and you're stuck with the facts and you think, God, why didn't they do this? Or why weren't they just a little more respectful when they terminated this person? They didn't give them the reason. And now that person thinks it's because of, you know, something worse than it was. When you look at the file, you can see all that, but just bad communication, right? Or not listening to people who might be whistleblowers or who might have something really significant to share. So I worked in HR for about 11 years. I worked my way up to workplace practices and policies, employee handbook. I had to do a major RIF and some benefits work and compensation, and then wound up being asked to move into the compliance and legal group to start the first compliance and ethics program. And this was at Fireman's Fund, Allianz.
Oh, wow.
And that was a whole new world. I thought I'd left the law behind permanently. So here I was kind of sort of circling back, but in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. Leveraging, but I had the HR experience for, you know, a decade, which wound up proving invaluable as a combination with learning compliance and ethics. And so many colleagues were so generous with me about teaching me the ropes on compliance and ethics in our associations that I know we're both involved with. Mm-hmm. Just incredibly generous. And then I jumped to McKesson to my first C-suite job on the US pharma executive team there and learned healthcare. And that was very different than financial services.
Right.
So I was really drinking from the fire hose, but I took it because I wanted to be reporting directly to a business person. I had been in kind of a center of excellence shared services model, and I knew it was important to learn it from the business side. And so that's that, you know, and adding another industry and having the privilege of building my own team from scratch, mm-hmm. the reasons that I left and went to McKesson. And that was one of the toughest jobs I've had and one of the places I learned the most in terms of building a team, you know, motivating others, stakeholder influence, building a program that arguably some people might not have wanted to spend money on, and having to fight for every dollar and every headcount. And my HR experience helped me with that in terms of, you know, doing a cost benefit analysis and making a business case. And then from there, I took a planned sabbatical. So I'd say the risk I took when I quit my job without a plan enabled me, as now a mom of two daughters, one of whom had a kind of a learning disability issue that I felt I was ignoring, mm-hmm. Not intentionally, but I was traveling 40% time.
Wow.
And I had significant responsibilities. And I felt like I'd gotten the program to a really good point for a transition for the next person. I'd been there 4.5 years. And so I took a planned sabbatical, Nick. And so this was a planned kind of perfect leave, if you will. I gave 3.5 months notice. I helped recruit my successor. I created break the glass procedures for my boss in case the DOJ came knocking. You know, I really tried to tie it up with a big bow. And then I left and I spent some more time with my family and got a handle on school and things like that, that are really important at certain points in your kids' lives. And I've always loved to work and I love my family. So I try to just pay attention to when I need to really double down on one versus the other. And it's an art. There's no perfect answer. And I know everyone makes their own choices, right? But that was one time where it was really clear to me that things had gotten out of balance. And I was grateful to have the opportunity and the presence to notice. And then I taught law school. I taught compliance and ethics in the Mission in San Francisco, and that was cool. And then I was debating whether to start my own business when I got headhunted by Spencer Stewart to be the CAO of the Dental Association. And that was too good to turn down. I was so excited about the opportunity to not have to choose between my two loves, law and compliance and HR, and oversee half the company. And so then I had IT, I had the project management organization overseeing all the major projects, and they were doing a startup. They had a captive insurance company and they had an association. So it was a very complex business model. And I wanted that too. And so I did that and helped them with a bunch of initiatives for a couple of years. And then decided that I thought that I kind of had had a great run with corporate and I was going to, and I wanted to do so many things that you can't necessarily do as an executive at a company, which is, you know, when you're an executive at a company, you are speaking for the company. And so I think you have, if you're doing your job, you have a special responsibility, fiduciary, in other words, to make sure that what you say is aligned with the company. And so it can feel like a gag order, though, if there are certain things you want to advocate for or work on in your personal life. Mm-hmm. People make different decisions on this. For me, you know, I was pretty hard-lined about it because I wanted to set an example as the, you know, compliance, HR.
Yeah, you're in that, you're in that position.
I felt an extra burden. I mean, how can I, you know, discipline someone or take action or write if it's too close to something I'm doing? Mm-hmm. So that's been great. So I founded my own consultancy about 3 years ago, coaching, writing, and now I can do such a variety of things, team workshops, retreats. I love my clients. I get so many amazing chief compliance officers and general counsel and heads of HR and others in other functions. But I have a particular soft spot for what I'll call gatekeeping roles because I feel like they're always under-resourced. They're the last ones thanked and the first ones blamed when something horrific goes wrong reputation-wise. And I feel like it's so important to equip technical, what I call knowledge workers like lawyers or compliance folks or doctors, IT people, spend so much of their time on their credentials, which are very important in those roles. But, and this is what my book is about.
Yeah. It's like a great transition. Yeah.
You get to a point where what got you here won't get you there, to quote my dear mentor, Marshall Goldsmith. And your technical skills are to the game, but you have to then hone up, bone up, and be absolutely ready to be a full business partner at the table, to be influential, to get your headcount, to get your initiatives passed, to get what you need, and to be able to stop the train when it's really important to do so.
Yeah, those credentials are great, to your point. Those are table stakes. That's going to get you in the game. But what you need to elevate is not, you know, when you're studying for the CPA, there's no section on executive presence, or perhaps there is in law school, but it's not held, at least as you're building your career, to the same standard as getting this tangible thing of like, okay, now I got the thing to put on the wall or the credential or whatever. But where the rubber meets the road and where the battle actually happens is in that game of influence, which you've obviously been adept at sort of developing and putting into practice.
Well, that's my hope, is to deconstruct all of this and reverse engineer it and then share it in ways that I hope inspire and motivate and equip people with very practical ways of upping their game so that they can do this in their respective fields. Cause I'd like to, I hope everyone, you know, in our field feels like they're supported. They can be rewarded for their work, both on a personal level as well as on a systems level in terms of helping the organization do the right thing.
You know, you said something at the start of that story where you were like, you know, it all kind of makes sense when you look at it in the rearview mirror. And it really does. You know that saying where they say, like, your life is perfectly designed to give you whatever outcome you're getting. You know, this string of experiences you had were really perfectly designed to put you in the spot to be influential on those gatekeeping folks who haven't equipped those skills, whether maybe they're not, you know, wired that way or they haven't had the experiences that you've had, really able to help equip them with the skills that they need to get over that hump or accelerate out of that gatekeeping role into more of that sort of business person mentality that you need to get to if you're going to be elevating to, you know, where you can go.
Yeah.
And something else that kind of struck me is, you know, you are a very principled person and it seems very genuine. And you also seem like a very confident person. There takes a certain confidence to say, you know what, I've had a good run here. Or, you know what, there takes a certain sort of confidence and presence, as you said, to say like, oh, my family piece is getting a little bit under focused. I need to kind of switch on that. And there's a confidence to say, hey, I need to take this sabbatical to prioritize this thing. Is that kind of unwavering, you know, quality that you have? You know, first of all, do you think I'm even reading that right? And then if that is in fact right, has that always been kind of a pillar of your personality, or do you think that's something that's developed over time?
I think it's always been a part of who I am, but I would say it didn't crystallize in a productive way until I was older.
Okay.
You know, when you're a kid, you're just acting, right? You're not thinking and you're not really self-reflective. And having been through two teenagers who are pretty good kids and their brain's still, you know, developing like we all do, their times were a little more self-absorbed, right? And we don't really think about how we're coming across to others. We judge ourselves by our intent and others by their impact. And I wish I had known that earlier. I would say, yeah, for me, life is a balance of courage and humility, or being able to be self-reflective. And I vacillate between both of those. So particularly with my writing, like what's going to be most helpful. I'm not always confident, for example, that what I'm writing is going to be what someone needs today. And I always try to think about that. And I really appreciate it when I get feedback around something being helpful, because that's the hardest thing as a solo
entrepreneur,
I would say, is that, you know, you don't get as much feedback as you did in corporate. And I kind of miss that, that group think or that running it by someone.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm sure that, you know, as you step out into this new thing of writing this book, there was probably a lot of anxiety around it. Like, is this right? Am I over analyzing this? Or, you know, is this going to be actually helpful for folks? You know, I've heard a lot of great things about the book since it's come out. I love it. What is some of the feedback you've been getting, and how has that feedback been like a lesson for you, or a confirmation of the confidence you should have, or something? You know what I'm saying? What is this resonance that you're starting to get back, and what are you hearing?
Yeah, thank you. I think what's most powerful, I did pilot it. So that was my way of proofing it. I piloted both the assessment, which is the first, there's really two parts to the toolkit. There's a self-assessment, which is free online. And then there's the book. And by doing the assessment last year and doing a bunch of webinars and corporate presentations for companies that wanted to help employees with career development and didn't know how, really, in a good way, in an easy, simple way to do that, they adopted it. I have a case study coming out on that. People asked for more, and that's really how the book was born. So I kind of listened to what people needed. And in this case, that made the guidebook easy. Because it's not a book. It has some elements of a book in terms of research and sharing key points, but it also is really a roadmap to your career. And so the feedback I've gotten is what I'd hope for, which is that it puts people's careers back in their own hands. It makes them feel, especially during a time in the pandemic where I think people felt despondent about the level of control that we have over things, that can be really demotivating and debilitating on our souls, really, to get really clear. There's been a lot of mental health and difficult issues this year, right? Especially, I think, for extroverts, which I'm definitely, and I think you probably are too.
I am too, yeah. Tough year.
So the book was a great channel for that. And so then organizations are adopting it as well to equip their leaders to have better, more objective discussions, is my hope, around promotions, because I know from being in the room where it happens that unfortunately it's maybe a poorly kept secret. I know it is in HR that you really have to have a sponsor and an advocate in the room for you when you reach a certain level.
Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. One of my heroes, Carla Harris, has done a fabulous TED talk on this. If people haven't watched it, you've got to watch it, about who's going to speak for you. And so the other way is for organizations to be really intentional about the qualities that they are choosing with leaders. And my hope is that they will look at the five elements, which is self-awareness, external awareness, strategic thinking, executive presence, and thought leadership. And then in each of those, I've also imbued it with good values and thinking about others and asking good questions and supporting your team. But my hope is that for particularly underrepresented groups or other people who may not have had access to mentors or sponsors or a boss that yeah. sponsored them and brought them up. And not everyone has that luck. I will say though, you can learn just as much from a bad boss as a good boss. So we could talk about that too. I certainly had my share, but, my hope is to make promotion accessible to those who want it. The other interesting bit of feedback I've gotten from people is because they take the word promotability very literally, and I understand, but for me, promotability is just future-proofing your career. It means you're a lifelong learner. It means you're aiming towards something you want and you're aiming to be a better and more influential person, and that everyone has that capability. I had about one colleague told me that about 30% of people at her company, when she implemented this amongst her team, said, you know, I don't want to be promoted. I'm happy where I am. And that's great. Companies need people that don't want to be promoted. We can't all, you know, be leaders. And some people don't want to manage people. And I understand why.
Totally.
It's not easy. It's a huge responsibility to manage people. And if you don't want it, you should not do it. You know, that was good too, because then it led to, okay, well, like, how can we keep your job interesting for you?
Right.
You don't want to be promoted. Like, what other projects might you want to, what other skills might you want to learn? What cross-functional stuff would be helpful to the company and could be really cool and interesting for you to diversify? Because most people don't want to do the exact same widget thing every day. I personally don't think we're built that way for human nature.
I think
we need, it's like grow or die, right? So that's been interesting as a finding as well.
You know, I've just been talking about this a lot since you sent it to me. And I've just been kind of like ranting and raving about it, because it seems like you've just kind of cracked this nut. You know, it seems like some people, man, they just get promoted and they just, you know, they move forward and they just sort of like gracefully dance through corporate, or they dance through these jobs and like the influence, like whatever buttons they're pressing, it seems to be done sort of on an effortless, you know, level. And then other folks, they get stagnated and, you know, one of their cylinders isn't firing. And I think the way you broke this down into these sort of, you know, five keys for promotability, it does sort of articulate all the facets of the shape that go into it. And obviously a lot of stuff nests out underneath, you know, self-awareness. What does that mean? What is, you know, how do you actually operationalize thought leadership and so forth? But, you know, how empowering must it be for somebody whose wheels are spinning and whose heart is there because they want to do more, you know, sidebar, that distinction between, you know, somebody who wants to get promoted and doesn't, you know, we kind of call those superstars versus rock stars. There can be great people who don't want to manage people. And to your point, we need to provide accessible opportunities for folks in the context of what they're looking for, if we're actually going to live out diversity, right? Our company should not just be places where type A personalities or just superstars can succeed, because to your point, you can't have all chiefs. You need, you know, solid people to do a particular task, and you're not any less than somebody else because you don't want to be a manager or whatever. But many times that difference is sort of implicitly there in our organizations. And many of those people who are more like that rock star, or maybe they're aspirational to be that superstar, but they don't know which of these levers they need to pull on more to gain purchase in terms of their own ascension in their organization. You articulate this well. And, you know, I was just kind of struck as you were talking about the feedback you were getting, as another little sidebar. Like, it's almost harder to write this kind of a book, I think, than just a regular book where it's just you talking, because someone's interacting with this and they have to put their own thoughts into it. And the process that you are sort of dictating to them for them to take through this book you know, there's feedback to each individual, whether this is working and whether it's uncovering, you know, deficiencies or weaknesses in them, or changing, you know, the need to change a perspective around a particular, you know, path toward, you know, promotability. And I think the fact that you're getting the level of feedback that you're getting, and how positive it is a confirmation that, you know, you've kind of cracked this nut, or you've kind of picked this lock on a, you know, a piece of content that I think is just materially more difficult to create.
Well, and the book and the assessment are designed to revisit over the course of your entire career. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anyone ever getting a perfect score on the assessment if they're accurately self-assessing their and that was intentional. I feel there's a lot that's aspirational and should be, you know, in life. And I also wanted it to be a bit of choose your own adventure. Nick, you and I've alluded to this, but some people aren't going to be interested in thought leadership. Some people are going to be more interested in strategic thinking, and that may fit their personality better. It takes a certain amount of extroversion, at least in being willing to throw your thoughts out there, to be criticized or debated with, mm-hmm. you know, to do thought leadership. And I do think that people that eventually want to be on a corporate board need to work on all of these five areas. But maybe at a certain point in your life and your development personally, one appeals to you more than the other. And so the book was also intended to not be linear. It's intended to just go to what speaks to you, go to what is motivating to you right now, because that'll probably be different in 2 years. And that's great, because that means you'll be doing different things at different times. And again, I hope my career is an example of that. Yeah. You can't learn everything at once. And no one should try to do everything in this book all at once. In fact, you know, there's a goal setting sheet and it says, pick the top two or maybe three things. And this is what I do in my coaching with my clients as well. We do a ton of data gathering, and then we hone in on what's their obstacle right now, where they're standing in their space right now, what would move the dial the most, because that changes.
Totally.
It changes depending on the context you're in, the business cycle you're in, the environment, like that pandemic,
totally.
You know, whether you need to spend more time with your kids at this time in their life, whether you have a health condition, I mean, fill in the blank, right? So there's certain things that are just going to work and that you're motivated towards at one point in your life, and it's going to shift. And so that takes this into account as well, because that's been my real life experience. And then my work in neuropsychology also bears that out.
Tell me some more about that neuropsychology work, because I'm just so fascinated with that field.
Well, it's around influence. It's a lot of my research around influence and around how the brain works and how we allow ourselves to be,
persuaded.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess, you know, two quick things around that is that we cannot influence other people if they don't believe in two things. The first is they need to believe that we like them. Not always easy if we actually don't, or we don't trust them, but it is a factor. And then the second is they need to believe that we are open to their influence. So there's a reciprocity,
yes.
Nick, around trust. And so, you know, I've had some clients with difficult relationships. Sometimes that's one of their obstacles, is say a key stakeholder that they don't get along with. So they don't trust them. So they don't like them. They may feel they're undermining them, or they always in a meeting, you know, disagree with their proposal, et cetera. And so we have to kind of break that down,
totally.
Knowing what's going to be effective.
So I definitely want to circle back to the influence piece, because to me, whatever change we want to drive, to the extent that you need somebody else to do it, it's going to be driven by, oh, hello there. We got a little guest. In order for that change to happen, somebody else has to agree with it, or you have to persuade them to do it. And again, you know, there's not like an influence class, or there's not a sales class when you're getting a law degree or when you're getting your compliance certification. But many times in these sort of center of excellence models, or in these key stakeholder models, or in these gatekeeper models, you know, whatever you want to call it, that is the, you know, that is the flat tire on the car, that influence piece. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, you mentioned at one point you're like, I need to get to the point where I'm reporting to a business person. So I'd love to hear a little bit about, first of all, like what turned that light bulb on for you to make you make that intentional switch toward elevating to that type of a role? And what was like your biggest surprise as you stepped into that realm in terms of the influence or how business actually got done or whatever? Like what like aha moments did you have once you were at that new tier or that new level?
I would say the number one thing was a shift in my perspective that we know it intellectually, but is a very different thing to experience. And that when I was responsible for multiple functions and or reporting to the business, compliance is only a part of what we do. And it can only occupy a part of a CEO or a business stakeholder's brain. They have to also be thinking about so many other things. And you know this as a business person too, everything from minimum viable product to clients to sales. And it can be, I think early in one's career, it can be very easy to get siloed in our heads about my stuff is the most important. How can they not see that?
Right.
And I do see situations where gatekeeping roles can get a bit of a martyr complex about, you know, we just have to do this. And that can get you fired, or it can get you sidelined. Yep. And I hate to see that happen when someone is in that role, because they probably have great ideas and they probably are just not executing. It's their how.
Yes.
It's not their what. Their what might be spot on, but their how is off because they're not getting the results and people aren't hearing them and they're tuning them out. And so that's where we need to understand how we're perceived. And this gets mm-hmm. to external awareness, the second of the key elements. External awareness is of the five qualities, Nick, the most underestimated, I think, by people, especially senior people. And self-awareness is around being really understanding our impact on other people and how we are perceived. And the tough thing about perception is, guess what? It's not always fair. Right. and we don't always like it. You know, anyone who's done a 360 has probably had a few comments in there that where we're like, what?
Right.
And very hurtful and really painful to read and felt really unfair and vindictive, or fill in the blank. I mean, it depends on the type of 360 you do. And having been in HR, I've administered a bunch of them. The ones that I do with my clients are interviews. And I make sure to avoid all the things that I didn't like when I was in HR about 360s. But it is important. It's better to know the perception than not, because if you don't know, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, right.
And so another thing that I work on with clients is when I get the 360s and I really get a good handle on the perception, we can work then to change the perception. We can create an action plan around, okay, you're perceived as a no person, to use a classic trope mm-hmm. for compliance officers. And that's an extreme one. I know most everyone knows this and works really hard to not be that person. But it can be perceived that way by sales or R&D or strategy, you know, right? We have our frequent flyers to compliance. And so it's just really trying to keep things a dialogue and figuring out, you know, how do we change that perception? I just have one client that had rubbed someone very powerful the wrong way 2 years ago, and he was being blocked for promotion.
Yeah.
And luckily we were able to find that out, because he was number one. This is a salesperson. Actually, he was number one salesperson, wasn't getting promoted. And couldn't figure out why. And I was able to get behind that. And then we created a plan around how to change the perception. He'd been perceived as a lone wolf and as someone who was a lone achiever and had to always be the star and had to always be right and took over meetings. And there are many reasons for that perception, but that was what this person two levels up, who only heard stuff, didn't get sure. to see my client in action very much. So that's where it's really important to know, because those conversations happen and you're not there. And so if you don't know that, you can't change it. And I'm happy to say we were able to change it over 6 months, and he did just get promoted. And he also happens to be the only man of color at his level before and now. And so that's awesome for so many reasons, because he's also head of his employee resource group for African-Americans at his company. Awesome. So, yeah. So, you know, it really does work. It takes hard work. And it's not always the work that you want to do. I think really shifting an obstacle or something that's been working for you for a very long time, because there's a reason we have these habits. There's a reason we work the way we do. And it's because it's been working mostly for us. The self-awareness comes in when you've got to realize, when is it not working for me anymore? And hopefully you have some truth tellers around you that will help you think about that, that'll be in a supportive but honest, candid way. And then you have to have a balance of humility and courage to work on it.
Yeah. And what I think there's so much opportunity in what you're talking about, because while people don't revisit those impressions, right? This boss thought this guy was a jerk. He's a lone wolf. You can't rely on him. He doesn't have whatever it is. He's not where he needs to be, whatever that
means. Can't. The big thing, Nick, was that they felt, well, he can't lead people. No one's going to follow him.
No one's going to follow him. Right. Because it's all about him, and it's all about, you know, him taking the stage and all those kinds of things. The point is, whether that's true or not, to your point, reality is his friend, and that perception is there. And while that person who has that perception in their mind or in their heart about this individual, they're not constantly revisiting it to say, do I have this wrong? Do I not have it wrong? Right? There's some permanence to it. It's also flexible in that if you apply new stimulus to that person, you can change that impression with a couple of data points, because in that person's mind, especially if it was, the basis for this impression was two steps removed and they see some direct evidence of something contrary to that, that perception can move very quickly, to your point. It's not a 3 or 6 year, 7 year, you know, hole I have to dig myself out of. It just takes that awareness and that courage and that focus to swing that in the direction that's maybe more accurate. You know
where people get stuck, Nick, is they keep getting stuck with their self-talk, which is, this isn't fair.
Correct.
Great point. This isn't true. And they don't get past that. And if they can't, those are people I don't work with. We try, but you know, cause it's pointless. If people want to live there, and there are people that we probably both know that are very comfortable living in that space. If, well, it's not fair, it's not true, it's their problem.
Well,
that's fine if you don't want to get promoted.
Correct.
And that's fine if you don't want to grow. It's a very comfortable place to be. And personally, I get it. I understand why people want to live there, but it's not going to potentially get you to where you want to go, because perception, as one of my colleagues, perception is the co-pilot to reality. Yeah, again, Carla Harris, got to credit her. And so you may not like it. It may feel really unfair. It may feel vindictive, you know, fill in the blank. But if that person has more power than you, or if they're a powerful peer, doesn't always have to be someone, you know, above you that can impact your career, it's important to pay attention to that.
Well, I mean, reality is your friend. You know what I'm saying? Whatever the facts are, I mean, we can live either in the present tense, which is what's actually happening, or we can live in this sort of conditional tense and just laden every sentence we speak with would, could, and should. But at the end of the day, what's actually happening is what you're dealing with. And, you know, I just love this is a great story, obviously, but because it really illustrates how movable those impressions are. And all those frameworks can be shattered with different stimulus and with different focus. And
no one sees us all the time. Yeah, only see a piece of reality, right? And so it's more like, you know, a dragonfly, like, right? I think that some people can see 6 or 8 out of the 50 perspectives of looking at who we are. Of course, our spouses and our families know us the best because they see us at all times.
Yeah.
But, you know, at work, you don't see all that, and you just have certain experiences. And so you can try to depersonalize it, try to just say, okay, this is just, for whatever reason, how they view me. I know I'm more capable than this.
Right.
I know I'm capable of changing this perception and set out on a plan to show them other data, other evidence that, yes, you do want to work with them. And yes, there are other options and there are other ways around, you know, this situation, and that you do want to lead, and that, so there are all kinds of things you can do.
Yeah. And I think the point is that all this stuff is dynamic, right? So you get this feedback. If you're aware of it, you can say, all right, well, is this who I am? Am I actually this way or am I not? And if you are actually that way, well, then there's work you can do on yourself to change those habits or change those tendencies. And if you're not actually that way, well, then there's work you can do on that person's perception of you to exhibit the fact that I am not actually exhibiting, you know, I don't live out these tendencies and stuff like that. And when you were talking about, you know, a couple of minutes ago, we were talking about how sometimes people's what is not messed up, their why is, or I'm sorry, their what's not messed up, it's their how they're going about their what. But I think in those situations, there's actually a deeper level where their why is usually on par with the organization, right? They want to make a difference in the world. They want to make things better.
Totally.
But we don't dive down to that. And but when there's that dissonance where it's like, well, I'm just trying to do the right thing, this person's why must be different than mine. Well, you don't know it's different than yours, and it's probably not different than yours. But that how piece is where this dissonance can come, and it can break the what, which is what people are actually interacting with. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, we need to try to not make our own assumptions and our own judgments about why someone's fighting us on a compliance or an ethics issue and try to get behind it. And that's where dialogue and really trying to understand someone else's point of view is so important.
So let me ask you this question. This is just something that I'm always kind of fascinated by. There are certain, you know, there are, while it's one life and a lot of people talk about work-life balance, I think it's really all about work-life harmony. But let's go back to the different spheres of our life. We have our health and we have our home life and we have our personal life and we have our work life. And there are certain coaches that we're willing to engage in certain realms. And there's other coaches that for some reason, it seems like because of that realm, like you don't want to engage with them. So, you know, I've seen people willing to get an interior designer to help them design their house, or willing to get them, you know, willing to, you know, bring on board a personal trainer to get their health better. But then there's this weird reticence to like get a coach in this area of their life that they spend most of their waking hours in to elevate their careers. What do you think is in there? Why don't people have that same thought about coaching in careers as they have in health? And you know what I'm saying? It's a bizarre dynamic.
I have a trainer. It's what's kept me sane, you know, virtually on Zoom during this whole time, the pandemic, when I wasn't going to the gym. I think the best leaders do have a coach.
I agree with
you. I don't know of a great CEO that doesn't have one. And it's because there used to be a stigma, I'd say, like 20, 30 years ago, around, oh, coaching was meant you were on your way out, and it's like a last ditch effort to try to fix you.
Got it.
You know. But the best companies realize that it is like athletic training, that it is like, you know, the guide by your side, and they do believe in it and they have coaching cultures. And in fact, many companies like Intel have already created their own internal coaching bench where they choose good leaders to become coaches as on a part-time basis. Wow. And they employees not in their business unit, to avoid any conflicts of interest and keep psychological safety, can choose one of the coaches and have a regular coaching relationship. And I know several of them because they were in my graduate coaching program, and they're just wonderful people. So that's one example. And there are other companies that have done it as well. And I think, frankly, as we move more and more towards AI and jobs getting automated that are routine and the jobs are preserved that require independent judgment and thinking and all of the qualities that make us very special as human beings, coaching is even more important. I hired coaches myself whenever I took a big job. So some of those that I mentioned to you, and I did it whether the company paid for it or not. You know, one thing I'll mention is I don't think that compliance officers ask HR enough whether it is a benefit that's offered, because I know it's a benefit that's offered to almost every other function at a certain level. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, but they won't advertise it. So sometimes you have to ask and you say, hey, I just want to get better. You know, I just onboarded a new client who's a chief risk officer. She's now on the ELT. She was the compliance officer, but she's been given, it's a fintech company. She's been given huge responsibility for a bank and a bunch of other things. and credit risk. And so, you know, we're working together on scaling. Mm-hmm. What happens when you go from one function to multiple? What changes? What do you need to know? Because it does shift what you need to know as a leader and how you operate, delegating more. So going back to your question, I think that finding the right coach is important. I would say, like, I'm not the right coach for every person. It is a very personal mm-hmm. thing. And so I would always advocate that people interview at least three coaches if they're considering it. And you'll learn great things about, you know, each one of them. Just short, we call them chemistry calls, to see if there's a fit, to see if there's, you know, an energy match. Because a coach can't work harder than the client and get results. The client has right. to be all in. So it's something that it's a mutual interview when I'm talking to someone to see, can I really help this person? You know, is this, for example, I don't do transition coaching. So I always refer that to some amazing colleagues of mine when people are unemployed and looking for a job, mm-hmm. not sure what they want to do. That's a niche. And I decided that I preferred work and that my best contribution was working with people who were, who had large remits and who were in a company and were being change leaders really and needed help with those kinds of shifts.
And I'm sure every single one is different. And I'm hoping you're going to say influence here, but where do you think, you know, people have the most work to do? Or, you know, if someone is listening to this and they're talking, you know, in their mind, you're like, yeah, I really want to get promoted. I really want to move to this next level. Obviously get the book, obviously do at least a chemistry call with Amy, obviously take the test, but where do you feel folks can start shifting their focus? And perhaps they don't have budget to get a coach right now. What areas in terms of maybe these big five do you see on average ENC or HR folks needing like the most work on, or is it just not even answerable?
Yeah, I'll give you one of the exercises in the book, which is if you do one thing, it's ask your boss, what one thing can I do to be more effective in my job?
Great question.
And then just sit and listen without judgment, without reacting, and ask if you need clarification, ask questions like, can you give me an example, or can you talk a little more about that, or please say more. Open-ended questions. Don't get defensive, right? It's, they're going to be testing to see if you really wanted the feedback. And you need to create a psychologically safe environment for your boss.
Right, exactly.
For
right.
the question to work. They need to know that you really want to hear their truthful answer. And then you thank them yep. for the feedback, and then you get to work on it. And one of two things will be true. Either it's a perception that you didn't know about, and it's like, oh my God, wow.
I'm coming okay. across that way. I can't believe it.
Change that. And then, you know, we've already talked about that. Or second, it might be something like, wow, that's so cool. I never heard that. Okay. I'm putting that on my development plan. And then check in, you know, every 2 to 3 months, ask them, say, I'm working on this. Thank you so much for that feedback. I really appreciate it. I am working on my presentation skills, for example. So I have a big meeting coming up next week where I know you're going to be present. Will you please take extra attention
Amazing.
And critique me and give me 2 or 3 things I did well, you know, at our one-on-one next after that presentation? And will you give me 2 or 3 pointers on things I could have done better? And then they know that you heard them. They're willing to give you more feedback because this is just the beginning of what you want and what leads to promotability, because leaders promote people they're comfortable with
right.
as well. And they want to be able to give them feedback. I believe I'm an optimist, Nick. So I believe that people ultimately want to help other people, but you do need to make it easy for them.
Right.
And so the question is, how do we make it easy for them? And how do we show them that we heard them, they had an impact, that it matters? And how do you show it? Well, you show up and you start showing the change.
You know, earlier in my career, I think, you know, I would have bosses and mentors, and I really looked up to these people a lot, and they almost seemed like different kinds of people. And as I've gotten to, you know, those levels, I'm just like, okay, well, this is just a regular person. And so to your point, you know, bringing a little bit of empathy to this boss or this, you know, manager or whoever you're trying to influence, and recognizing that this person is probably, you know, they have a knot in their stomach before a presentation themselves, and they get nervous with their boss, and they probably watch the same shows on Netflix as I do. And, you know, if they, you know, whatever, if they eat too much fried food, they probably feel sick. Any of those kinds of things can help level the playing field. And then it's easier to put yourself in their shoes. And to your point, if you can make life easier for that manager, it's going to make a world of difference. If somebody, you know, most people have something to say. I have some feedback to give to most people. But I don't want to sap them. I don't want to. I don't want to suck the life out of them. I don't want to demotivate
them. You don't give it to them unless they ask you, probably, right?
Well, I mean, I'll say when people are asking for it, the relationship just ends up. I just run so much better with them because I feel like, okay, I feel safe telling them something. I know they're not going to just crumble under it. They're actually aligned with me and the direction that I have. You know, the vision that we have for the company and things like that. And so, to your point, like, just going through that exercise and shutting up when you ask for it and not getting defensive and recognizing that it's probably uncomfortable for that person to give you the feedback and showing some genuine appreciation so that when you thank them, they actually believe it. And then following back up afterwards and having that follow through, that makes that person's life so much easier. And I can just tell you that those back channel conversations or those back office conversations, when that manager is talking to his peers or talking to his boss about, you know, how much easier you're making your life, your influence begins to kind of pop up in more places, and your reputation can actually get some real tailwinds because of these little conversations that you're having with your direct report, you know?
It has exponential benefits because it also, just by asking the question, it shows that you want to always improve. It shows that you're willing to be vulnerable and have courage in asking the question. And it just usually, you get extra snaps again, 100%. Just for asking. So, and it has all these amazing benefits of being considered, you know, for other roles, or them feeling more bonded to you in the relationship and feeling more comfortable having the conversations. So if I just had to pick one thing, that would be it, Nick.
I love that. I think that's, it's so critical. And what's nice is that it's right there for us. This is not saying, hey, fish, we need to get you some wings and teach you how to fly. We're all empathetic people, right? Like many of us in the ethics and compliance and human resource game, we're people first people. We want to make a difference in the world. And so there's essentially an oversampling of like empaths in our industry. And that's what allows us to make great connections with our neighbors and with our friends and have these deep relationships outside of work. And I'm just saying dropping our guard a little bit and employing more of that natural human nature that we have in the context of the hierarchy that we're positioned in just freaking opens up so many doors and really greases the skids to start moving forward in an authentic way, because people authentically trust you, or they authentically believe in you, or they authentically believe that you want to have, you know, that you have that feedback and you're someone that they can count on. There's just, to your point, exponential externalities from this kind of an approach.
May I share one favorite quote with you that sure. I think you'll enjoy? It's from Peter Drucker, who was just one of the most amazing, you know, business thinkers of all time. And his quote is, you should not change yourself, but create yourself. And that means build around your strengths and remove your bad habits.
Love that.
And I love that too, because there's a lot of talk right now about authenticity. And I understand, and there's a certain, I think, very important context for that. And we do have to figure out how to work with other people.
Right.
And that's not changing our core values, but it does mean creating ourselves and how we interact in a way that's going to be effective to achieve results for everyone.
Which you can never achieve without a level of awareness, both internal and external, to have high confidence interval around what qualities actually separate you from those around you. You know, I mean, look, if you believe that everybody's different and everybody at least has genius inside of them, whether it's been unleashed or not, that's a different question. But if you believe that to be true, well, then all of our geniuses are a little bit different. And so standing on that genius that you might have, or standing on those gifts, that doesn't have to be an arrogant thing. And being able to articulate those things and, to your point, lean into those things and prune away these bad habits or whatever that are maybe contradictory to those can allow us to authentically not only present ourselves, but authentically move in our workspaces in, you know, more effective ways, you know?
Absolutely.
So this has been a lot of fun. I want to be conscious of time. Let's talk about how folks can find you. How can they learn more about you? How can they get your book? Let's kind of end there.
Thank you. Well, I'll start with a gift. I kept the Promotability Index free. And anyone can get it by texting the word promote me, all one word, to 44222. And that's the 82 question self-assessment that breaks down promotability into the five elements that Nick and I've been discussing today. You can also get it online through my website. I have a ton of free resources on my website. I make all my articles, podcasts, other things, even things that are behind the paywall. Usually Compliance Week generously enables me to PDF my articles and put them on there for my column, which again, some companies can't afford to pay for that. So that's really nice. My HBR articles are on there, but you do have to be an HBR subscriber. They're the only ones that won't let me.
You can't arm wrestle them, huh? You can't arm wrestle that away from them, huh?
Harvard's Harvard.
Well, Harvard's not Compliance Week, let's be honest here.
And then my book is available anywhere books are sold. I went on a tour of independent bookstores when I was in Boston a couple weeks ago, which was super fun. It's through Barnes & Noble, of course, through Amazon, and through my website. And it's in three different formats. There's an interactive PDF, there's a Kindle version, and then there's the paperback, which is my personal favorite because I incorporated aspects of journaling. And there's a neuroscience around journaling and writing down that it creates a greater commitment. If you, just like when you speak things out loud to an accountability partner. So I personally prefer the paperback. And then I think we'll have a hardcover coming out in November.
Well, thank you for sharing all that. We'll put some of that stuff in the show notes. And again, I just want to thank you for coming on. You've had a bigger impact on me and my business than you probably know. I've learned so much from you and, just those sessions of, those kind of weekly accountability sessions that we'd have and crush it with courage things like it had such a big impact on my life. And I just, so thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for all your work. I love your work. I love the impact that you're having and just really thankful to know you and to be fighting alongside you every day.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me.